The springs are all still flowing, and Perrin has ordered more wells dug. Actually, he had only suggested it, but it had come to the same thing, fortunately. And long before planting time, the irrigation canals from the Waterwood will be done. That was her doing. Half the fields in Saldaya were irrigated, but no one here had ever heard of the practice. Anyway, the rains have to come sooner or later. The canals are only in case. Daza nodded again, slowly, and Elwyn and Adela, but they knew all this as well as she. "It isn't the rain," Milla muttered. "Not exactly, anyway. It isn't natural. You see, none of us can listen to the wind." She hunched her shoulders under the other's secret frowns. Plainly she was saying too much, and giving away secrets besides. Supposedly all the wisdoms could predict the weather by listening to the wind. At least they said that they all could. But even so, Milla ploughed on doggedly. "Well, we can't. We look at clouds instead, and how the birds behave, and the ants and caterpillars, and—" Drawing a deep breath, she straightened, but still avoided the other wisdom's eyes. Fael wondered how she managed to deal with the women's circle in Taran Ferry, much less the village council. Of course, they were as new at it as Milla. That village had lost its whole population when the Trollocs came, and everyone there now was new. "It isn't natural, my lady. The first snows should have been here weeks ago, but it might as well be the middle of summer. We're not worried, my lady, we're frightened. If nobody else will admit it, I will. I lie awake most nights. I haven't slept properly in a month, and—" She trailed off, color blooming in her face as she realized she might have gone too far. A wisdom was supposed to be in control in all times. She did not run around saying she was frightened. The others shifted their gazes from Milla to Fael. They said nothing, faces expressionless enough for Aes Sedai. Fael understood now. Milla had spoken simple truth. The weather was not natural. It was most unnatural. Fael often lay awake herself, praying for rain, or better still, snow, trying not to think of what lurked behind the heat and drought. Yet a wisdom was supposed to reassure others. Who could she go to when she needed reassurance herself? These women might not have known what they were doing, but they had come to the right place. Part of the compact between noble and commoner, ingrained in Fael from her birth, was that nobles provided safety and security. And a part of giving security was to remind people that evil times were not forever. If today was bad, then tomorrow would be better, and if not tomorrow, then the day after. She wished she could be certain of that herself, but she had been taught to give those under her strength, even when she had none herself, to soothe their fears, not infect them with her own. "Perrin told me about his people before I ever came here," she said. He was not a man to brag, but things had a way of coming out. "When hail flattens your crops, when the winter kills half your sheep, you buckle down and keep going. When Trollocs devastated the two rivers, you fought back, and when you were done with them, you set about rebuilding without missing a step." She would not have believed that without seeing for herself, not of Southerners. These people would have done very well in Saldaya, where Trolloc raids were a matter of course, in the northern parts at least. "I cannot tell you the weather will be what it should tomorrow. I can tell you that Perrin and I will do what needs to be done, whatever can be done. And I don't need to tell you that you will take what each day brings, whatever it is, and be ready to face the next. That is the kind of people the Two Rivers breeds. That is who you are." They truly were intelligent. If they had not admitted to themselves why they had come, they had to now. Had they been less intelligent, they might have taken umbrage. But even words they had said themselves before had the desired effect coming from someone else. Of course, that carried its own embarrassment. It was a proper muddle, and they were a study in crimson cheeks and unspoken wishes to be somewhere else. "Well, of course," Daza said. Planting stout fists on ample hips, she stared at the other wisdoms, daring them to gainsay her. "I've said as much, haven't I? The girl talks sense. I said as much when she first came here. That girl has a head on her, I said." Adela sniffed. Did anyone say she didn't, Daisa? I didn't hear it. She does very well. To Fail, she added, You do very well, indeed. Mila bobbed a curtsy. Thank you, Lady Fail. I know I've said the same to 50 people, but coming from you, somehow it... A loud harumph from Daisa cut her short. That was going too far. Mila grew redder in the face. This is very nice work, my lady. Elwyn leaned forward to finger the narrow, divided riding skirt that Fail favored. There's a Tarabonner seamstress down in Devon Ride who could do even better for you, though, if you don't mind my saying. I had a word with her, and she only makes decent dresses now, except for married women. That motherly smile came onto her face again, indulgent and iron at the same time. Or if they're courting. Beautiful things she makes. Why, she'd count it a pleasure to work with your colouring and figure. Daisy began smiling complacently before the other woman was done. Thurilla Marza, right here in Emmons Field, is already making Lady Fail half a dozen dresses and the most beautiful gown. Elwyn drew herself up, and Adela pursed her lips, and even Mila looked thoughtful. As far as Fail was concerned, the audience was over. The Damani seamstress required a firm hand and constant vigilance to keep her from dressing Fail for the court in Ebu Dar. The gown had been Daisa's idea, sprung as a surprise, and even if it was in the Saldaean style rather than Damani, Fail did not know where she was to wear it. It would be a long time before the Two Rivers ran to balls or promenades. Left to themselves, the Wisdoms would soon be competing to see which village would dress her. She offered them tea, with a casual comment that they could discuss how to hearten the people about the weather. That hit too close to home after the last few minutes, and they nearly tripped over themselves, regretting duties that would not allow them to stay. Thoughtfully she watched them go, Mila drawing up the rear as usual, a child tagging after older sisters. It might be possible to have a few quiet words with some of the women's circle in Taran Ferry. Each village needed a strong mayor and a strong wisdom to stand up for their interests. Quiet, careful words. When Perrin had discovered she'd been talking to the men in Taran Ferry before the election for mayor, if a man had good wits and was strong for her and Perrin, why should the men who were going to vote not know that she and Perrin returned that support? When he found out... He was a gentleman, slow to anger, but just to be safe she had barricaded herself in their bedroom until he cooled down, which had not happened until she promised not to interfere again in any mayoral election, in the open or behind his back. That last had been most unfair of him. It was most inconvenient, too. But it had not occurred to him to mention women's circle voting. Well, what he did not know would do him a great deal of good. And Taran Ferry, too. Thinking of him made her remember her promise to herself. The feathered fan picked up speed. Today had not been the worst for nonsense, and not even the worst with the Wisdoms. There had been no questions about when Lord Perrin could expect an heir, the light be blessed. But maybe the unrelenting heat had finally screwed her irritation to the sticking place. Perrin would do his duty, or... Thunder rolled over the manor, and lightning hit the windows. Hope swelled inside her. If rain had come... She ran silently on slippered feet, searching out Perrin. She wanted to share the rain with him, and she still intended a few firm words. More than a few, if necessary. Perrin was where she expected, all the way up on the third floor on the roofed porch at the front, a curly-haired man in a plain brown coat, with heavy shoulders and arms. Broad back to her, he was leaning against one of the porch columns, staring down at the ground to one side of the manor, not up at the sky. Fail stopped in the doorway. Thunder boomed again, and lightning sheeted blue across the sky, heat lightning in a cloudless sky. Not a herald of rain. No rain to break heat, no snow to follow. Sweat beaded on her face, but she shivered. "The audience is over," Perrin said, and she jumped. He had not raised his head. It was difficult sometimes to remember how sensitive his hearing was, or he could have smelled her. She hoped it was the perfume, not the sweat. "I half thought I'd find you with Gwil or Hal." That was one of his worst faults. She tried to train servants, and to him they were men to laugh with and have a mug of ale. At least he did not have a roving eye, as so many men did. He never realized Calla Coplin had taken service in the manor because she hoped to do more for Lord Perrin than make his bed. He had not even noticed when Fael chased Calla out with a stick of kindling. Moving up beside him, she saw what he was watching. Two men, stripped to the waist, working with wooden practice swords below. Tam Al-Thor was a solid, graying man, Aram slender and young. Aram was learning fast, very fast. Tam had been a soldier and a blade master, but Aram was pressing him hard. Automatically her eyes went to the tents clustered in a stone-fenced field half a mile toward the westward. The rest of the tinkers were camped amid half-finished wagons like small houses on wheels. Of course they no longer acknowledged Aram as one of them, not since he had picked up that sword. The Tuatha An never did violence, not for any reason. She wondered whether they would go as they planned when the wagons the Trollocs had burned were replaced. After gathering in all those who had hidden in the thickets, they yet numbered little more than 100. Probably they would, leaving Aram behind of his own choice. No Tuatha An had ever settled in one place that she had ever heard. But then people in the Two Rivers used to say nothing there ever changed, yet a great deal had since the Trollocs. Emmons Field, just 100 paces south of the manor, was larger than she had first seen, all the burned houses rebuilt and new going up, some in brick, another new thing, and some with tile roofs. At the rate new dwellings were being erected, the manor would be in the village soon. There was talk of a wall in case the Trollocs returned. Change. A handful of children were following Loyal's great height along one of the village streets. Only a few months since the sight of the Ogier, with his tufted ears and broad nose almost as wide as his face, half again as tall as a man, had drawn every child in the village in gaping wonder, and their mothers in a terror to protect them. Now mothers sent their children for Loyal to read to them. The outlanders, in their strangely cut coats and dresses, dotted among Emmons Fielders, stood out almost as much as Loyal, but no one looked at them twice, or at the village's three Aiel, strange tall folk in browns and greys. Until a few weeks ago there had been two Aes Sedai here, as well, and even they had gotten no more than respectful bows and curtsies. Change. The two flagpoles not far from the wine spring on the green were visible over the rooftops, one bearing the red-bordered red wolf's head that had become Perrin's sigil, the other the crimson eagle in flight that marked Manetheran. Manetheran had vanished in the Trolloc Wars some 2,000 years ago, but this land had been part of it, and the Two Rivers flew that flag almost by acclamation. Change, and they had no notion how large it was, how inexorable it was. But Perrin would see them through it to whatever came beyond. With her help, he would. "I used to hunt rabbits with Gwil," Perrin said. "He's only a few years older than me, and he used to take me hunting sometimes." It took her a moment to remember what he was talking about. "Gwil is trying to learn how to be a footman. You don't help him when you invite him to go smoke his pipe with you in the stables and talk horses." She took a deep, slow breath. This would not be easy. "You have a duty to these people, Perrin. However hard it is, however much you want not to, you have to do your duty." "I know," he said softly. "I can feel him tugging at me." His voice was so strange that she reached up to grip his short beard and make him look down at her. His golden eyes, still as strange and mysterious to her as ever, looked sad. "What do you mean? You might think fondly of Gwil, but he—" "It's Rand, Fael. He needs me." The knot inside her that she had been trying to deny clenched even tighter. She had convinced herself this danger had gone with the Aes Sedai. Foolish, that. She was married to a Taviran, a man fated to bend lives around him into the shape the pattern required, and he had grown up with two more Taviran, one the dragon reborn himself. It was a part of him she had to share. She did not like sharing even a hair, but there it was. What are you going to do?
Go to him.
His gaze shifted for a moment, and her eyes followed. Against the wall leaned a blacksmith's heavy hammer and an axe with a wicked half-moon blade, and a haft a pace long.
I couldn't... His voice was almost a whisper. I couldn't find how to tell you.
I'll go tonight when everyone's asleep. I don't think there's much time, and it could be a long way. Master Althor and Master Cawthon will help you with the mares if you need it. I spoke to them. He tried to make his voice lighter, a pitiful effort. You shouldn't have any trouble with the wisdoms, anyway. Funny, when I was a boy, the wisdoms always seemed so fearsome, but they're really easy as long as you're firm. Fael compressed her lips. So he had spoken to Tam Althor and Abel Cawthon, had he, but not to her? And the wisdoms? She would like to make him wear her skin for a day and see how easy the wisdoms were. We can't leave as quickly as that. It will take time to organize a proper entourage. Perrin's eyes narrowed. We? You're not going. It will be... He coughed, went on in a milder tone. It will be best if one of us stays here. If the Lord goes off, the lady should remain to take care of things. That makes sense. More refugees every day. All those disputes to be settled. If you go, too, it'll be worse than the Trollocs around here. How could he think she would not notice such a clumsy recovery? He had been going to say it would be dangerous. How could his wanting to keep her out of danger always make her feel so warm inside, at the same time it made her so angry? We will do what you think best, she said mildly. And he blinked suspiciously, scratched his beard, then nodded. Now it was only necessary to make him see what really was best. At least he had not said right out she could not go. Once he dug in his heels, she could as easily shift a grain barn with her hands as shift him. But with care, it could be avoided. Usually. Abruptly, she threw her arms around him and buried her face against his broad chest. His strong hand smoothed her hair softly. He probably thought she was worried about him leaving. Well, she was, in a way. Just not about him leaving without her. He had not yet learned what it meant to have a Saldaean wife. They had been getting on so well away from Randalthor. Why did the dragon reborn need Perrin now, so strongly that Perrin could feel it across however many hundred leagues lay between them? Why was time so short? Why? Perrin's shirt clung to his sweaty chest, and the unnatural heat sent more sliding down her face, but Fael shivered.
One hand on his sword hilt, Gawain Trakand, bounced a small rock on his palm as he made another circuit of his men, checking their positions around the tree-topped hill. A dry, hot wind carrying dust across the rolling brown grasslands fluttered the plain green cloak hanging down his back. Nothing to be seen but dead grass, scattered thickets, and a dotting of mostly withered bushes. There was too much front to cover with the men he had if it came to a fight here. He had grouped them in clusters of five swordsmen afoot, with bowmen 50 paces back up the hill. 50 more waited with lance and horse near the camp on the crest, to be committed where necessary. He hoped it would not be necessary today. There had been fewer younglings in the beginning, but their reputation brought recruits. The added numbers would be helpful. No recruit was allowed out of Tar Valon until he was up to standard. It was not that he expected fighting this day more than any other, but he had learned it came most often when unexpected. Only Aes Sedai would wait until the last minute to tell a man about a thing like what was to happen today. "Is everything well?" he said, stepping beside a group of swordsmen. In spite of the heat, some wore their green cloaks so that Gawain's white charging boar showed, embroidered on the breast. Jasau Hamora was the youngest, still with a boy's grin, but he was also the only one of the five with the small silver tower on his collar, marking him a veteran of the fighting in the White Tower. He answered, "All is well, my lord." The younglings deserved their name. Gawain himself, a few years past 20, was among the oldest. It was a rule that they accepted none who had served in any army, or borne arms for any lord or lady, or even worked as a merchant's guard. The first younglings had gone to the tower as boys and young men to be trained by the warders, the finest swordsmen, the finest fighters in the world. And they continued part of that tradition, at least, though warders no longer trained them. Youth was no detriment. They had held a small ceremony only a week past for the first whiskers Benjy Dalfour had ever shaved that were not fuzz, and he bore a scar across his cheek from the tower fighting. The Aes Sedai had been too busy for healing in the days right after Swan Sanche was deposed as Amarlin. She might still be Amarlin if the younglings had not faced many of their former teachers and bested them in the halls of the tower. "Is there any point to this, my lord?" Almuar asked. He was 2 years older than Jussau, and like many who did not wear the silver tower, he regretted not having been there. He would learn. "There isn't a glimmer of Aielman."
"You think not?"
Without any hefting to give warning, Gawain hurled the rock as hard as he could, at the only bush close enough to hit, a scraggly thing. The rustle of dead leaves was the only sound, but the bush shook just a bit more than it should have, as though a man somehow hidden behind it had been struck in a tender place. Exclamations rose from the newer men. Jussau only eased his sword.
"An Aielhal can hide in a fold in the ground you wouldn't even stumble over."
Not that Gawain knew any more of Aiel than he read in books, but he had read every book he could find in the White Tower's library by any man who had actually fought them, every book by any soldier who seemed to know what he was talking about. A man had to ready himself for the future, and it seemed the world's future was war.
"But if the light pleases, there won't be any fighting today."
"My lord!"
came a hail from up the hill, as the lookout spotted what he just had. Three women emerging from a small thicket a few hundred paces west, coming toward the hill. West? A surprise. But Aiel always liked surprise. He had read about Aiel women fighting alongside the men, but these women could never fight in those dark, bulky skirts and white blouses. They carried shawls looped over their arms despite the heat. On the other hand, how had they reached that thicket unseen?
"Keep your eyes open, and not on them," he said,
and then disobeyed himself by watching the three wise ones, the emissaries from the Shido Aiel, with interest. They could be no other out here. They came on at a stately pace, not at all as if approaching a large party of armed men. Their hair was long, to the waist. He had read that Aiel kept it cut short and held back by folded kerchiefs. They wore so many bracelets and long necklaces of gold and silver and ivory that the glitter should have given them away at a mile. Straight-backed and proud-faced, the three women strode past the swordsmen with hardly a glance and started up the hill. Their leader was a golden-haired woman, her loose blouse unlaced to show considerable tanned cleavage. The other two were gray, with leathery faces. She had to be less than half their age.
"I wouldn't mind asking that one to dance," one of the younglings said admiringly, when the women had gone past.
He was a good 10 years younger than the golden-haired woman.
"I wouldn't if I were you, Arwen," Gawain said dryly. "It might be misunderstood."
He had read that Aiel called battle the dance.
"Besides, she'd have your liver for dinner."
He had caught a glimpse of her pale green eyes, and he had never seen harder. He watched the wise ones until they had climbed the hill to where half a dozen Aes Sedai waited with their warders. Those who had warders. Two were red Aja, and reds did not. When the women disappeared into one of the tall white tents, and the five warders had taken up guard around it, he went on with his circuit of the hill. The younglings were alert since word of the Aiel's arrival had spread, which did not please him. They should have been this alert before. Even most who did not wear the Silver Tower had seen fighting around Tarvalin. Eamon Valda, the white-cloaked lord captain in command, had pulled nearly all his men out to the west more than a month ago, but the handful he left behind tried to keep together the brigands and bully boys Valda had gathered. The younglings had dispersed those, at least. Gawain wished he could think they had driven Valda off, too. The tower had certainly kept its own soldiers far from the skirmishing, For all that the White Cloak's only reason for being there had been to see what harm they could do to the tower. But he suspected that Valda had his own reasons. Likely orders from Pedron Nile, and Gawain would have given much to know what they were. Light, but he hated not knowing. It was like fumbling your way in the dark. The truth was, he admitted, that he was irritated. Not only about the Aiel, about not being told of this meeting until this morning. He had not been told where they were going, either, until he was taken aside by Quarren Sedai, the Grey Sister who led the Aes Sedai. Elida had been close-mouthed and imperious when she was his mother's advisor in Camelon. Since being raised to the Amelan seat, she made the old Elida seem open and warm. No doubt she had pressured him to form this escort, as much to get him away from Tar Valon as for any other reason. The younglings had sided with her in the fighting. The old Amelan was stripped of staff and stole by the Hall, the attempt to free her, rebellion against the law, clear and simple. But Gawain had had his doubts about all Aes Sedai, long before he heard the charges against Swan Sanche read. That they pulled strings and made thrones dance was a thing said so often that he had hardly paid it any mind. But then he saw the strings being pulled. The effects, at least. And his sister Elaine was the one who danced right out of his sight. Out of existence, for all he knew. Her and another. He had fought to keep Swan imprisoned, then turned around and let her escape. If Elida ever discovered that, his mother's crown would not keep him alive. Even with that, Gawain had chosen to stay, because his mother had always supported the tower, because his sister wanted to be Aes Sedai, and because another woman wanted to, Egwene Alvear. He had no right to even think of her, but abandoning the tower would be abandoning her. For such flimsy reasons did a man choose his fate. Knowing they were flimsy did not change them, though. He glared at the sere, wind-swept grasslands as he strode from one position to the next. So here he was, hoping the Aiel did not decide to attack, despite, or because of, whatever it was the Shido Wise Ones were talking over with Quarren and the others. He suspected that there might be enough out there to overrun him, even with Aes Sedai help. He was on his way to Cairhien, and he did not know how he felt about that. Quarren had made him swear to hold his mission secret, and even then seemed afraid of what she was saying. Well, she might be. It was always best to examine carefully what an Aes Sedai said. They could not lie, but they could spin truth like a top. Yet even so, he found no hidden meanings. The six Aes Sedai were going to ask the Dragon Reborn to accompany them to the tower, with the younglings, commanded by the son of the Queen of Andor, for an escort of honor. There could be only one reason, one that plainly shocked Quarren enough that she only hinted at it. It shocked Gawain. Elida intended to announce to the world that the White Tower supported the Dragon Reborn. It was almost unbelievable. Elida had been a Red before she became Amerlin. Reds hated the very idea of men channeling. They did not think much of men in general, for that matter. Yet the fall of the once-inevitable Stone of Tyr, fulfilling prophecy, said Randall Thor was the Dragon Reborn. And even Elida said the last battle was coming. Gawain could hardly reconcile the frightened farm boy who had literally fallen into the royal palace in Camelon with the man in the rumors that drifted up the river Arinon to Tar Valon. It was said he had hanged Tyran Highlords and let Aiel loot the stone. He had certainly brought the Aiel across the spine of the world, for only the second time since the breaking, to ravage Cairhien. Perhaps it was the madness. Gawain had rather liked Randall Thor. He regretted that the man had turned out to be what he was. By the time he came back to Jisawa's group, someone else was in sight coming from the west, a peddler in a floppy hat leading a slab-sided pack mule. Straight toward the hill, he had seen them. Jisawa shifted, then went still again when Gawain touched his arm. Gawain knew what the younger man was thinking, but if the Aiel decided to kill this fellow, there was nothing they could do. Quarren would be less than pleased if he started a battle with the people she was talking to.
The peddler shambled along unconcernedly, right by the bush Gowan had disturbed with his rock. The mule started cropping desultorily at the brown grass as the man pulled off his hat, sketched a bow that took them all in, and began mopping his grizzled face with a grimy neckerchief.
"The light shine on you, my lords. You're well set up for traveling in these parlous times, as any man can see. But if there's any small thing you need, like as not old Mill Teason's got it in his packs. Ain't no better prices than 10 miles, my lords."
Gowan doubted there was as much as a farm within 10 miles.
"Parlous times indeed, Master Teason. Aren't you afraid of Aiel?"
"Aiel, my lord? They're all down to Cairhien. Old Mill can smell Aiel, he can. Truth, he wishes there were some here. Fine trading with Aiel. They got lots of gold from Cairhien. And they don't bother peddlers. Everybody knows that."
Gowan forbore asking why, if the Aiel and Cairhien made such good trading, the man was not heading south.
"What news of the world, Master Teason? We are from the north, and you may know what hasn't caught up to us yet from the south."
"Oh, big doin' southward, my lord. You'll have heard of Cairhien, him that calls himself Dragon and all?"
Gowan nodded, and he went on.
"Well, now he's taken Andor. Most of it, anyway. Their queen's dead. Some say he'll take the whole world before—"
The man cut off with a strangled yelp before Gowan realized he had seized the fellow's lapels.
"Queen Morgaisa's dead. Speak, man, quickly!"
Teason rolled his eyes, looking for help, but he spoke, and quickly.
"That's what they say, my lord. Old Mill don't know, but he thinks it's so. Everybody says it, my lord. Everybody says this dragon did it. My lord! Old Mill's neck, my lord! My lord!"
Gowan jerked his hands away as though burned. He felt on fire inside. It had been another neck he wanted in his hands.
"The daughter heir."
His voice sounded far off.
"Is there any word of the daughter heir, Elaine?"
Teason backed away a long pace as soon as he was free.
"Not as old Mill knows, my lord. Some say she's dead, too. Some says he killed her, but old Mill don't know for sure."
Gowan nodded slowly. Thought seemed to be drifting up from the bottom of a well.
"My blood shed before hers. My life given before hers. Thank you, Master Teason. My blood shed before hers."
That was the oath he had taken when barely tall enough to peer into Elaine's cradle.
"You may trade with... some of my men may need..."
Gareth Bryn had had to explain to him what it meant, but even then he had known he had to keep that oath if he failed at everything else in his life. Jassau and the others were looking at him worriedly.
"Take care of the peddler,"
he told Jassau roughly, and turned away. His mother dead, and Elaine. Only a rumor, but rumors on everyone's lips sometimes had a way of turning out true. He climbed half a dozen paces toward the Aes Sedai camp before he knew it. His hands hurt. He had to look to realize they were cramping from the grip he had on his sword hilt, and he had to force them to let go. Quarren and the others meant to take Randall Thor to Tar Valon. But if his mother was dead, Elaine... if they were dead, he would see whether the dragon reborn could live with a sword through his heart.
Adjusting her red-fringed shawl, Katerina Al-Ruddin rose from the cushions with the other women in the tent. She almost sniffed when Quarren, plump and pompous, intoned, "As it has been agreed, so shall it be." This was a meeting with savages, not the conclusion of a treaty between the tower and a ruler. The Aiel women showed no more reaction, no more expression than when they first arrived. That was something of a surprise. Kings and queens betrayed their innermost feelings when faced by two or three Aes Sedai, much less half a dozen. Brutish savages surely should be trembling visibly by now. Perhaps that should have been almost no reaction. Their leader, her name was Savannah, followed by some nonsense about thefts and Shido Aiel and Wise, said, "It is agreed so long as I get to see his face." She had a sulky mouth and wore her blouse unlaced to attract men's eyes. That the Aiel chose one like her to lead showed how crude they were. "I want to see him and have him see me when he is defeated. Only with that will your tower be allied to the Shido." The hint of eagerness in her voice made Katerina suppress a smile. Wise? This Savannah truly was a fool. The White Tower did not have allies. There were those who served its ends willingly, and those who served unwillingly, no others. A slight thinning at the corners of Quarren's mouth betrayed her irritation. The Grey was a good negotiator, but she did like to have things done just so, every foot placed exactly where it had been planned to go. "Without doubt, your service deserves what you ask." One of the grey-haired Aiel, Tarva or some such, narrowed her eyes, but Savannah nodded, hearing what Quarren had wanted her to hear. Quarren set out to escort the Aiel women as far as the foot of the hill, along with Arianne, a green, and Nasuna, a brown, and the five warders they had between them. Katerina went as far as the edge of the trees to watch. On arrival, the Aiel had been allowed to come up alone, like the supplicants they were, but now they were given all honor to make them believe they truly were friends and allies. Katerina wondered whether they were civilized enough to recognize the subtleties. Gawain was down there, sitting on a rock, staring off across the grasslands. What would that young man think if he learned he and his children were only here to get them away from Tar Valon? Neither Elida nor the Hall liked having a pack of young wolves about who refused to accept the leash. Perhaps the Shido could be prevailed upon to eliminate the problem. Elida had intimated as much. That way his death would not rebound against the tower with his mother. "If you stare so at the young man much longer, Katerina, I will begin to think you should be a green." Katerina stamped out a quick spark of anger and inclined her head respectfully. "I was only speculating on his thoughts, Galina," said I. That was as much respect as was proper in so public a place, and perhaps even a touch more. Galina Kazban looked less than Katerina's true age at most, and was twice that, and for 18 years the round-faced woman had been the head of the Red Aja. A fact not known outside the Aja, of course. Such things were for the Aja alone. She was not even one of the sitters for the Red in the Hall of the Tower. Katerina suspected that the heads of most other Ajas were. Elida would have named her leader of this expedition, instead of that self-important Quarren, except that Galina herself had pointed out that a Red might make Randall Thor suspicious. The Ammerlin seat was supposed to be of all Ajas and none, renouncing her old loyalty. But if Elida deferred to anyone, which was debatable, true, she deferred to Galina. "Will he come willingly, as Quarren thinks?" Katerina asked. "Perhaps," Galina said dryly. "The honor this delegation does him should be enough to make a king carry his throne to Tar Valon on his back." Katerina did not bother to nod. "The woman Savannah will kill him, given a chance." "Then she must not be given a chance." Galina's voice was cold, her plump mouth tight. "The Ammerlin seat will not be pleased to have her plans disrupted, and you and I will have days to scream in the dark before we die." Drawing her shawl up over her shoulders reflexively, Katerina shuddered. There was dust in the air. She would get out her light cloak. It would not be Elida's rage that killed them, though her fury could be terrible. For 17 years Katerina had been Aes Sedai, but not until the morning before they departed Tar Valon had she learned that she shared more than the Red Aja with Galina. 12 years she had been a member of the Black Aja, never knowing that Galina had too, for far longer. Of necessity, black sisters kept themselves hidden, even from each other. Their rare gatherings were held with faces covered and voices disguised. Before Galina, Katerina had known only two to recognize. Orders were left on her pillow or in a pocket of her cloak, the ink ready to vanish if any hand but hers touched the paper. She had a secret place to leave messages and dire orders not to try to see who came to take them. She had never disobeyed. There might be black sisters among those following a day behind, but she had no way of knowing. "Why?" she asked. Orders to preserve the dragon reborn made no sense, even if they delivered him into Elida's hands. Questions are dangerous for one sworn to obey without. Katerina shuddered again and barely stopped herself from curtsying. "Yes, Galina," said I. But she could not help wondering, "Why?"
"They show neither respect nor honor," Tarava growled. "They allow us to enter their camp as though we were toothless dogs, then take us out under guard like suspected thieves."
Savannah did not look around. She would not until safely back among the trees. The Aes Sedai would be watching for signs of nervousness. "They agreed, Tarava," she said. "That is enough for now."
"For now.
One day these lands would be the Shido's for the looting, including the White Tower."
"This is all badly thought out," the third woman said in a tight voice. "Wise ones avoid Aes Sedai. It has always been so. Perhaps it was well enough for you, Savannah, as Kuladin's widow and Suladric's. You speak as clan chief until we send another man to Roydian. But the rest of us should be no part of it."
Savannah barely forced herself to keep walking. Desain had spoken against her being chosen as a wise one, speaking loudly about her having served no apprenticeship and paid no visit to Roydian, claiming that her place standing for the clan chief disqualified her. Besides, as the widow of not just one but two dead chiefs, perhaps she carried bad luck. Fortunately, enough of the Shido wise ones had listened to Savannah, not Desain. It was unfortunate that Desain had too many listeners to be safely done away with. Wise ones were supposed to be inviolate. They even came and went freely among the Shido from those betrayers and fools down in Kyrian, but Savannah meant to find a way. As though Desain's doubts had infected Tarava, she began muttering only half to herself. "What is ill done is going against Aes Sedai. We served them before the breaking and failed them. That is why we were sent to the Threefold Land. If we fail them again, we will be destroyed." That was what everyone believed. It was part of the old tales, almost part of custom. Savannah was not so sure. These Aes Sedai looked weak and foolish to her, traveling with a few hundred men for escort through lands where the true Aiel, the Shido, could smother them with thousands. "A new day has come," she said sharply, repeating part of one of her speeches to the wise ones. "We are no longer bound to the Threefold Land. Any eye can see that what was has changed. We must change, or be ended as if we never were." She had never told them how much change she intended, of course. The Shido wise ones would never send a man to Roydian if she had her way. "New day or old day," Desain grumbled. "What are we to do with Randall Thor if we do manage to take him from the Aes Sedai? Better and easier to slip a knife between his ribs while they are escorting him north." Savannah did not answer. She did not know what to answer, not yet. All she knew was that once she had the so-called Karakarn, the chief of chiefs of all the Aiel, chained before her tent like a vicious dog, then this land would truly belong to the Shido. And to her. She had known that, even before the strange wetlander man somehow found her in the mountains these people called Kinslayer's Dagger. He had given her a small cube of some hard stone, intricately carved in strange patterns, and told her what to do with it, with the aid of a wise one who could channel, once Althor was in her hands. She carried it in her belt pouch at all times. She had not decided what to do about it, but so far she had told no one about man or cube. Head high, she walked on beneath that blistering sun in an autumn sky. The palace garden might have had a semblance of coolness had there been any trees, but the tallest things were fanciful topiary,
tortured into the shapes of running horses or bears performing tumblers' tricks or the like. Shirt-sleeved gardeners scurried about with buckets of water beneath the scalding afternoon sun, trying to save their creations. They had given up on the flowers, clearing all the patterned beds and laying them with sod that was dying, too. "A pity the heat is so bad," Aelron said, sweeping a lace handkerchief from the lace-fringed sleeve of his yellow silk coat. He dabbed delicately at his face, then tossed it aside. A servant in gold and red livery quickly snatched it from the graveled walk and faded into the background again. Another liveried man laid a fresh replacement in the king's hand to be tucked up his sleeve. Aelron did not acknowledge it, of course, or even appear to notice. "These fellows usually manage to keep everything alive till spring, but I may lose a few this winter, since it doesn't seem as if we'll have any winter. They take cold better than drought. Don't you think they're very fine, my dear?" Aelron, anointed by the light, king and defender of Amadicia, guardian of the southern gate, was not as handsome as rumor made him, but then Morgaze had suspected when she first met him years ago that he might be the source of those rumors himself. His dark hair was full and wavy, and quite definitely receding in front. His nose was a bit too long, his ears a touch too big. His whole face vaguely suggested softness. One day she would have to ask, "The southern gate to what?" Working her carved ivory fan, she eyed one of the gardener's constructs. It seemed to be three huge nude women wrestling desperately with gigantic serpents. "They are quite remarkable," she said. One said what one must when coming as a beggar. "Yes, yes, aren't they? Ah, it looks as if affairs of state call me. Pressing matters, I fear." A dozen men, coated as colorfully as the flowers that were no longer there, had appeared on the short marble stair at the far end of the walk, and were waiting in front of a dozen fluted columns that supported nothing. "Until this evening, my dear. We will speak further of your dreadful problems, and what I can do." He bowed over her hand, stopping just short of kissing it, and she curtsied slightly, murmuring appropriate inanities, and then he swept away, followed by all but one of the coterie of servants that had been trailing them everywhere. With him gone, Morgaze worked the fan harder than she could in his presence. The man pretended the heat barely touched him, with sweat streaming down his face, and turned back toward her apartments. Hers by sufferance, just as the pale blue gown she wore was a gift. She had insisted on the high neck, despite the weather. She had definite ideas about low necklines. The lone serving man followed behind her at a short distance, and Talanvor, of course, on her heels and still insisting on wearing the rough green coat he had traveled here in, sword on his hip as though he expected an attack in the Saranda Palace, not 2 miles from Amador. She tried to ignore the tall young man, but as usual he would not be ignored. "We should have gone to Gildan, Morgaze, to Johanna." She had let some things go on far too long. Her skirts swished as she whirled to confront him, and her eyes blazed. "On our journey, certain discretions were necessary, but those around us now know who I am. You will remember that, too, and show proper respect for your queen. On your knees." To her shock, he did not move. "Are you my queen, Morgaze?" At least he lowered his voice so the servant could not overhear and spread it about. But his eyes. She very nearly backed away from the stark desire there, and the anger. "I will not abandon you this side of death, Morgaze, but you abandoned much when you abandoned Andor to Gabriel. When you find it again, I will kneel at your feet, and you can strike off my head if you choose. But until then, we should have gone to Gildan." The young fool would have been willing to die fighting the usurper even after she discovered that no house in Andor would support her. And day by day, week by week, since she had decided her only choice was to seek foreign aid, he had grown more insolent and insubordinate. She could ask Aelron for Talon Vor's head and receive it with no questions asked, but just because they were unasked did not mean they would be unthought. She truly was a beggar here, and could not afford to ask one favor more than absolutely necessary. Besides, without Talon Vor, she would not be here. She would be a prisoner, worse than a prisoner, to Lord Gabriel. Those were the only reasons Talon Vor would keep his head. Her army guarded the ornately carved doors to her apartments. Basil Gill was a pink-cheeked man with graying hair combed vainly back over a bald spot. His leather jerkin, sewn with steel discs, strained around his girth, and he wore a sword he had not touched in 20 years before belting it on to follow her. Lam Gwyn was bulky and hard, though heavy-lidded eyes made him look half asleep. He wore a sword, too, but the scars on his face and a nose broken more than once made it plain he was used to employing fists or a cudgel. An innkeeper and a street tough. Aside from Talon Vor, that was the army she had so far to take back Andor and her throne from Gabriel. The pair were all awkward bows, but she glided past and slammed the door in Talon Vor's face. "The world," she announced in a growl, "would be a far better place without men." "An emptier place, certainly," Morgaze's old nurse said from her chair beside a velvet-draped anteroom window. With her head bent over her embroidery hoop, Linny's gray bun waggled in the air. A reed-thin woman, she was not nearly so frail as she looked. "I assume Aelron was no more forthcoming today? Or is it Talon Vor, child? You must learn not to let men put you in a fret. Fretting makes your face blotchy." Linny still would not admit that she was out of the nursery, despite having been nurse to Morgaze's daughter in turn. "Aelron was charming," Morgaze said carefully. The third woman in the room, on her knees taking folded bedsheets from a chest, sniffed loudly, and Morgaze avoided glaring at her with an effort. Brianna was Lam Gwyn's companion. The short, suntanned woman followed where he went, but she was Kyrianan, and Morgaze was no queen of hers, as she made clear. "Another day or two," Morgaze continued, "and I think I will get a pledge from him. Today he finally agreed I need soldiers from outside to retake Camelin. Once Gabriel is driven from Camelin, the nobles will flock to me once more." She hoped they would. She was in Amadicia because she had let Gabriel blind her, had mistreated even her oldest friends among the houses at his behest. "A slow horse does not always reach the end of the journey," Linny quoted, still intent on her embroidery. She was very fond of old sayings, some of which Morgaze suspected her of making up on the spot. "This one will," Morgaze insisted. "Talon Vor was wrong about Gildan. According to Aelron, that country was in near anarchy because of this prophet all the servants whispered about, the fellow preaching the rebirth of the dragon." "I would like some punch, Brianna." The woman only looked at her until she added, "If you please." Even then she set about the pouring with a wooden sulkiness. The mixture of wine and fruit juices was iced and refreshing in the heat. The silver goblet felt good against Morgaze's forehead. Aelron had snow and ice brought down from the mountains of mist, though it took nearly a steady stream of wagons to provide enough for the palace. Linny took a goblet, too. "Concerning Talon Vor," she began after a sip. "Leave over, Linny," Morgaze snapped. "So he is younger than you," Brianna said. She had poured for herself as well. The effrontery of the woman! She was supposed to be a servant, whatever she had been in Kyrian. "If you want him, take him. Lam Gwyn says he has sworn to you, and I have seen him look at you." She laughed huskily. "He will not refuse." Kyrianan were disgusting, but at least most of them kept their dissolute ways decently hidden. Morgaze was about to order her from the room when a knock came at the door. Without waiting permission, a white-haired man who looked all sinew and bone entered. His snowy cloak was emblazoned with a flaring golden sun on the breast. She had hoped to avoid white cloaks until she had Aelron's seal on a firm agreement. The chill of the wine abruptly passed straight into her bones. Where were Talonvor and the others that he had walked right in? Dark eyes going straight to her, he made the most minimal of bows. His face was aged, the skin drawn tight, but this man was as feeble as a hammer. "Morgaze of Andor," he said in a firm, deep voice. "I am Pedro Nile." Not just any white cloak, the Lord Captain Commander of the Children of the Light himself. "Do not fear. I have not come to arrest you." Morgaze held herself straight. "Arrest me? On what charge? I cannot channel." No sooner were the words out of her mouth than she nearly clicked her tongue in exasperation. She should not have mentioned channeling. That she had put herself on the defensive was an indication of how flustered she was. It was true what she had said, so far as it went. 50 times trying to sense the true source to find it once, and when found, 20 times attempting to open herself to Sidar in order to catch a dribble once. A brown sister named Varen had told her that there was hardly any need for the tower to hold her until she learned to handle her tiny abilities safely. The tower did anyway, of course. Still, even that much ability to channel was outlawed in Amadicia, the penalty death. The great serpent ring on her hand that so fascinated Aelron now seemed hot enough to glow. "Tower trained," Niall murmured. "That is forbidden as well. But as I said, I come not to arrest, but to help. Send your women away, and we will talk." He made himself at home, taking a tall, padded armchair and flipping his cloak over the back. "I will have some of that punch before they go." To Morgaze's displeasure, Brianna brought him a goblet immediately, eyes down and face as expressionless as a board. Morgaze made an effort to take back control. "They stay, Master Nile." She would not give this man the satisfaction of a title. The lack did not appear to faze him. "What has happened to my men outside? I will hold it against you if they've been harmed. And why do you think I need your help?" "Your men are uninjured," he said dismissively over his punch. "Do you think Aelron will give you what you need? You are a beautiful woman, Morgaze, and Aelron prizes women with sun-gold hair. He will come a little closer each day to the agreement you seek, never quite reaching it, until you decide that perhaps with a certain sacrifice he will yield also. But he will come no nearer what you want, whatever you give. This so-called prophet's mobs ravage the north of Amadicia. To the west lies Tarabon, with a 10-sided civil war, brigands sworn to the so-called dragon reborn, and rumors of Aes Sedai and the false dragon himself to frighten Aelron. Give you soldiers? Could he find 10 men for every one he has under arms now, or even 2, he would mortgage his soul. But I can send 5,000 children of the light riding to Camelon with you at their head if you but ask." To say she was stunned would have been to minimize Morgaze's feeling. She made her way to a chair across from him with a proper stateliness and sat down before her legs gave way. "Why would you want to help me oust Gabriel?" she demanded. Obviously he knew everything. No doubt he had spies among Aelron's servants. "I've never given the White Cloaks the free rein they want in Andor." This time he grimaced. White Cloaks did not like that name. "Gabriel, your lover is dead, Morgaze. The false dragon Randall Thor has added Camelon to his conquests." Linny made a faint noise as if she had pricked herself, but he kept his eyes on Morgaze. For herself, Morgaze had to grip the arm of her chair to keep from pressing a hand against her stomach. If her other hand had not been resting the goblet on the other chair arm, she would have slopped punch onto the carpet. Gabriel dead? He had gulled her, turned her into his doxy, usurped her authority, oppressed the land in her name, and finally named himself King of Andor, which had never had a king. How, after all that, could there possibly be this faint regret that she would never feel his hands again? It was madness. If she had not known it was impossible, she would have believed he had used the one power on her in some way. But Al-Thor had Caemlyn now? That might change everything. She had met him once, a frightened country youth from the West, trying his best to show proper respect for his queen. But a youth carrying the Heronmark sword of a blade master. And Elida had been wary of him. Why do you call him a false dragon, Niall? If he intended to call her by name, he could do without even a commoner's master. The Stone of Tyr has fallen, as the prophecies of the dragon said. The High Lords of Tyr themselves have acclaimed him the Dragon Reborn. Niall's smile was mocking. Everywhere he has appeared, there have been Aes Sedai. They do his channeling for him, mark me. He is no more than a puppet of the tower. I have friends in many places, he meant spies, and they tell me there's evidence the tower set up Loghain, the last false dragon, too. Perhaps he got above himself, so they had to finish him. There is no proof of that. She was pleased that her voice was steady. She had heard the rumors about Loghain on the way to Amador, but they were only rumors. The man shrugged. Believe as you will, but I prefer truth to foolish fancies. Would the true dragon reborn do as he has done? The High Lords acclaimed him, you say? How many did he hang before the rest bowed down? He let Aiel loot the stone and all of Cairhien. He says Cairhien shall have a new ruler, one he will name. But the only real power in Cairhien is himself. He says there will be a new ruler in Caemlyn, too. You are dead. Did you know that? There is mention of the Lady Dailin, I believe. He has sat on the Lion Throne, used it for audiences, but I suppose it was too small, being made for women. He has put it up as a trophy of his conquest, and replaced it with his own throne in the grand hall of your royal palace. Of course, all has not gone well for him. Some Andorran houses think he killed you. There's sympathy for you now you're dead. He holds what he holds of Andor in an iron fist, though, with a horde of Aiel and an army of borderland ruffians the tower recruited for him. But if you think he will welcome you back to Caemlyn and give you back your throne... He let the words trail off, but the torrent had hit Morgaze like hailstones. Dailin was next in line for the throne only if Elaine died without issue. Oh, light! Elaine! Was she still safe in the tower? Strange to think she had such an antipathy for Aes Sedai, largely because they had lost Elaine for a time, that she had demanded Elaine's return when no one demanded anything from the tower, yet now she hoped they held her daughter tightly. She remembered one letter from Elaine after she returned to Tar Valon. Had there been others? So much of what had happened while Gabriel held her in thrall was vague. Surely Elaine must be safe. She should be worried about Gawain, too, and Galad. The light knew where they were. But Elaine was her heir. Peace in Andor depended on a smooth succession. She had to think carefully. It all hung together, yet well-crafted lies did, and this man would be a master at that craft. She needed facts. That Andor believed her dead was no surprise. She'd had to sneak from her own realm to avoid Gabriel and those who might turn her over to him or else avenge Gabriel's wrongs on her. If sympathy came from it, she could make use of it when she rose from the dead. Facts. I will need time to think, she told him. Of course. Niall rose smoothly. She would have risen too, so he did not tower over her, but she was not sure her legs would support her. I will return in a day or two. In the meantime, I wish to be sure of your safety. Aelron is so wrapped in his own concerns, there is no telling who might slip in, perhaps intent on harm. I have taken the liberty of posting a few of the children here, with Aelron's consent. Morgaze had always heard that the White Cloaks were the true power in Amadicia, and she was certain she had just heard proof. Niall was slightly more formal in his leaving than in coming, making a bow that might have done for an equal. One way and another, he was letting her know that she had no choice. No sooner had he gone than Morgaze pushed to her feet, but Brianna was still quicker in darting for the doors. Even so, before either woman had gone 3 steps, one of them banged open, Tullinvor and the other 2 men spilling into the room. "Morghese," Tullinvor breathed, trying to absorb her with his eyes. "I was afraid." "Afraid," she said contemptuously. It was too much. He would not learn. "Is this how you protect me? A boy could have done as much. But then a boy did." That smoldering gaze remained on her a moment longer. Then he turned and pushed his way past Basil and Lamgwyn. The innkeeper stood wringing his hands. "They were at least 30, my queen. Tullinvor would have fought. He tried to cry out to warn you, but they clubbed him with a hilt. The old one said they didn't mean to hurt you, but they didn't need any but you, and if they had to kill us..." His eyes went to Linny and Brianna, who was staring Lamgwyn up and down to make sure he had taken no injury. The man appeared as concerned for her. "My queen, if I'd thought we could do any good... I'm sorry. I failed you." "The right medicine always tastes bitter," Linny murmured softly. "Most of all for a child who throws a sulky tantrum." At least for once she did not say it for the whole room to hear. She was right, Morghese knew that, except about the tantrum, of course. Basil looked miserable enough to welcome beheading. "You did not fail me, Master Gil. I may ask you to die for me one day, but only when there's greater good to come of it. Niall only wanted to talk." Basil perked up right away, but Morghese could feel Linny's eyes on her. Very bitter. "Will you ask Tullinvor to come to me? I wish to apologize to him for my hasty words." "The best way to apologize to a man," Brianna said, "is to trip him in a secluded part of the garden." Something snapped in Morghese. Before she knew it, she had hurled her goblet at the woman, spraying punch across the carpet. "Get out!" she shrieked. "All of you, get out! You can deliver my apologies to Tullinvor, Master Gil." Brianna calmly brushed punch from her dress, then took her time walking to Lamgwyn and linking her arm through his. Basil was all but bouncing on his toes, trying to herd them out. To Morghese's surprise, Linny went too. That was not Linny's way. She was much more likely to remain and lecture her old charge as if she were still 10. Morghese did not know why she put up with it. Still, she almost told Linny to stay. But then they were all gone, the door was shut, and she had more important matters to worry about than whether Linny's feelings were bruised. Pacing across the carpet, she tried to think. Aelron would demand trade concessions, and maybe Niall's sacrifice for help. She was willing to give him the trade concessions, but she feared Niall might be right about how many soldiers Aelron would spare her. Niall's demands would be easier to grant, in a way. Probably free access to Andor for as many white cloaks as he chose, and freedom for them to root out the dark friends they found in every attic, to rouse mobs against friendless women they accused of being Aes Sedai, to kill real Aes Sedai. Niall might even demand a law against channeling, against women going to the White Tower. It would be possible, but difficult and bloody, to oust the White Cloaks once they entrenched themselves, but was it necessary to let them in at all? Randall Thor was the Dragon Reborn. She was certain of that no matter what Niall said. She was almost certain. Yet ruling nations was no part of the prophecies of the dragon that she knew. Dragon reborn or false dragon, he could not have Andor. Yet how was she to know? A timid scratch at the door brought her around. "Come," she said sharply. The door opened slowly to admit a grinning young man in gold and red livery, a tray in his hands bearing a fresh pitcher of iced punch, the silver already beading with cold. She had half expected Tullinvor. Lamgwyn stood guard alone in the corridor, as far as she could see, or rather lounged against the wall like a tavern bouncer. She waved the young man to put his tray down. Angrily, Tullinvor should have come. He should have come, she resumed her pacing. Basil and Lamgwyn might hear rumors in the nearest village, But they would be rumors, and maybe planted by Niall. The same held true for the palace servants. My queen. May I speak, my queen? Morgaze turned in amazement. Those were the accents of Andor. The young man was on his knees, grin flashing from uncertain to cocky and back. He might have been good-looking except that his nose had been broken and not properly tended. On Lamgwyn it looked rugged, if low. This lad looked as if he had tripped and fallen on his face. "Who are you?" she demanded. "How did you come here?" "I'm Piter Conal, my queen, from Market Sharon, in Andor," he added, as if she might not realize that. Impatiently she motioned him to go on. "I came to Amador with my uncle Jen. He's a merchant from Four Kings, and he thought he might find some Tarabonor dyes. They're dear with all the troubles in Tarabon, but he thought they might be cheaper." Her mouth tightened, and he went on in a rush. "We heard about you, my queen, that you were here in the palace, and given the law in Amadicia and you being trained in the White Tower and all, we thought we could help you—" He swallowed hard, and finished in a small voice, "help you escape." "And are you prepared to help me escape?" Not the best plan, but she could always ride north to Gildan. How Talanvor would gloat. No, he would not. And that would be worse. But Piter shook his head wretchedly. "Uncle Jen had a plan, but now there's white cloaks all over the palace. I didn't know what else to do but come on to you the way he told me. He'll think of something, my queen. He's smart." "I'm sure he is," she murmured. So Gildan went glimmering again. "How long are you gone from Andor? A month? Two?" he nodded. "Then you don't know what is happening in Camelin," she sighed. The young man licked his lips. "We're staying with a man in Amador who has pigeons, a merchant. He gets messages from everywhere, Camelin too. But it's all bad news that I hear, my queen. It may take a day or two, but my uncle will figure out another way. I just wanted to let you know help was nearby." Well, that was as might be. A race between Pedro Niall and this Piter's Uncle Jen. She wished she were not so sure how to bet. "In the meantime, you can tell me just how bad matters are in Camelin." "My queen, I was just supposed to let you know about the help. My uncle will be angry if I stay—" "I am your queen, Piter," Morgaze said firmly. "And your Uncle Jen's, too. He will not mind if you answer my questions." Piter looked as though he might bolt, but she settled herself in a chair and began digging for the truth.
Pedro Niall was feeling quite good as he dismounted in the main courtyard of the Fortress of the Light and tossed his reins to a stableman. Morgaze was well in hand, and he had not had to lie once. He did not like lying. It had all been his own interpretation of events, but he was sure of it. Randall Thor was a false dragon and a tool of the Tower. The world was full of fools who could not think. The last battle would not be some titanic struggle between the Dark One and a dragon reborn, a mere man. The Creator had abandoned mankind to its own devices long ago. No. When Tommen Gaedan came, it would be as in the Trolloc Wars 2,000 years ago and more, when hordes of Trollocs and other shadow spawn poured out of the Great Blight, tore through the borderlands, and nearly drowned humanity in a sea of blood. He did not mean to let mankind face that divided and unprepared. A ripple of bows from white-cloaked children followed him through the stone-walled corridors of the fortress, all the way to his private audience chamber. In the anteroom, his pinch-faced secretary, Balwer, leaped to his feet with a fussy recitation of papers awaiting the Lord Captain's signature. But Niall's attention was on the tall man who rose easily from one of the chairs against the wall. A crimson shepherd's crook, behind the golden sun in his cloak, and three golden knots of rank below. Jakim Caradin, Inquisitor of the Hand of the Light, looked as hard as he was, but with more gray at his temples than the last time Niall had seen him. His dark, deep-set eyes held a tinge of worry, and it was no wonder. The last two missions he had been given ended in disaster, not auspicious for a man who aspired to be High Inquisitor one day, and perhaps even Lord Captain Commander. Tossing his cloak to Balwer, Niall motioned Carradine to follow into the audience chamber proper, where captured battle flags and the banners of old enemies made trophies on the dark-paneled walls, and a huge sunburst set into the floor held enough gold to make most men stare. Aside from that, it was a plain soldier's room, a reflection of Niall himself. Niall seated himself in a high-backed chair, well-made but undecorated. The long twin hearths at either end of the room stood swept and cold at a time of year when they should have held roaring fires. Proof enough that the last battle was near. Garadin bowed deeply and knelt on the sunburst, worn smooth by centuries of feet and knees.
"Have you speculated on why I sent for you, Carradine?"
After Almuth Plain and Falma, after Tanchico, the man could not be blamed if he believed he was to be arrested. But if he suspected such a possibility, nothing showed in his voice. As usual, he could not help showing that he knew more than anyone else, definitely more than he was supposed to.
"The Aes Sedai and Altara, my Lord Captain Commander. A chance to wipe out half the Tarvalan witches right on our doorstep."
An exaggeration. A third were in Salidar, perhaps, but no more.
"And have you speculated aloud among your friends?"
Niall doubted that Carden had any, but there were those he drank with. Of late, got drunk with. The man had certain skills, though. Useful skills.
"No, my Lord Captain Commander, I know better than that."
"Good," Niall said. "Because you are not going anywhere near this Salidar, and neither is any other of the children."
He could not be sure whether it was relief that flashed across Carradine's face. If so, it was out of character. The man had never shown any lack of courage, and relief certainly did not suit his reply.
"But they are waiting to be snapped up. This is proof the rumors are true. The tower is divided. We can destroy this lot without the others raising a hand. The tower could be weakened enough to fall."
"Think you so?" Niall said dryly. He laced his fingers across his middle and kept his voice mild. Questioners. The hand despised that name, but even he used it. Questioners never saw anything not shoved under their noses. "Even the tower can hardly come out openly for this false dragon, Althar. What if he turns, as Loghain did?"
"But a rebel group?"
"They could support him, and the White Tower's skirts are clean, whatever happens."
He was sure that was the way of it. If not, there would be ways to use any real split to further weaken the tower. But he believed he was right.
"In any case, what the world sees matters. I will not let them see merely a struggle between the children and the tower."
Not until the world saw the tower for what it was, a sink of dark friends meddling with forces mankind was not meant to touch. The force that had caused the breaking of the world.
"This struggle is the world against the false dragon Althor."
"Then if I am not going to Altara, my Lord Captain Commander, what are my orders?"
Niall let his head fall back with a sigh. He felt tired suddenly. He felt all of his years and more.
"Oh, you will be going to Altara, Carradine."
Randall Thor's name and face had been known to him since shortly after the supposed invasion from across the sea at Falma, an Aes Sedai plot that had cost the children 1,000 men and begun the spread of the Dragonsworn and Chaos across Taraban and Arad-Daman. He had known what Althor was and believed he could use him as a goad to force the nations to unite. Once bound together, behind his leadership, they could have disposed of Althor and been ready for the Trolloc hordes. He had sent emissaries to every ruler of land to point out the danger. But Althor moved faster than he could believe even now.
He had meant to let a rabid lion roam the streets long enough to frighten everyone, but the lion had become a giant that moved like lightning. Yet all was not lost, he had to keep reminding himself. More than 1,000 years ago, Guer Amalasan had named himself the Dragon Reborn, a false dragon who could channel. Amalasan had conquered more land than Althor now held, before a young king named Artapan Drag Tanrial took the field against him and began his own climb to empire. Niall did not consider himself another Artar Hawkwing, but he was what the world had. He would not give up while he lived. Already he had begun to counter Althor's growing strength. Besides emissaries to rulers, he had sent men to Taraban and Arad-Daman. A few men to find the right ears, to whisper that all their troubles could be laid at the feet of the Dragonsworn. Those fools. And dark friends who had declared for Althor. And at the feet of the White Tower. Plenty of rumors already came out of Taraban of Aes Sedai involved in the fighting, rumors to ready men's ears to hear the truth. Now was the time to launch the next part of his new plan, to show the fence-sitters which side to choose. Time. He had so little time. Yet he could not help smiling. There were those, now dead, who had once said, "When Niall smiles, he is going for the throat."
"Altara and Murundi," he told Caradin, "are about to be tormented by a plague of dragonsworn."
The chamber had the appearance of a palace sitting room, vaulted ceiling of worked plaster, finely woven carpets on the white-tiled floor, elaborately carved paneling for the walls, though it was far from any palace. Indeed, it was far from anywhere in any way that most humans would understand. Messana's russet silk dress rustled as she moved around a lapis-inlaid table, amusing herself with the placement of ivory dominoes in a complex tower, each level larger than the one below. She prided herself on doing this purely with a knowledge of stresses and leverage, not a thread of the power. She had the tower to 9 levels. In truth, more than amusing herself, she was avoiding conversation with her companion. Semirag sat doing needlework in a high-backed chair covered in red tapestry, long slender fingers deftly making minuscule stitches to form a labyrinthine pattern of tiny flowers. It was always a surprise that the woman liked an activity so ordinary. Her black dress was a sharp contrast against the chair. Not even Demon Dread dared suggest to Semirag's face that she wore black so often because Lanfear wore white. For the 1,000th time, Messana tried to analyze why she felt uncomfortable around the other woman. Messana knew her own strengths and weaknesses with the One Power and elsewhere. She matched well with Semirag on most points, and where she did not, she had other strengths to lay against weaknesses in Semirag. It was not that. Semirag took delight in cruelty, a pure pleasure in giving anguish, but that surely was not the problem. Messana could be cruel where necessary, and she did not care what Semirag did to others. There had to be a reason, but she could not find it. Irritably, she placed another domino, and the tower collapsed with a clatter, spilling ivory tiles onto the floor. With a click of her tongue, she turned from the table, folding her arms beneath her breasts. "Where is Demon Dread? 17 days since he went to Shael Ghul, but he waits until now to inform us of a message, then does not appear." She had been to the Pit of Doom twice in that time herself, made that nerve-racking walk with the stone fangs brushing her hair, to find nothing except a strange, too-tall murdral that would not speak. The boar had been there, certainly, but the great lord had not answered. She did not remain long either time. She had thought herself beyond fear, at least the sort a half-man's gaze brought, but twice the murdral's silent, eyeless stare had sent her away with quickening steps that only tight self-control had kept from becoming a run. Had channeling there not been a sure way to die, she would have destroyed the half-man, or traveled from the pit itself. "Where is he?" Semirag raised her eyes from her stitchery, unblinking dark eyes in a smooth, dark face, then put aside the needlework and stood gracefully. "He will come when he comes," she said calmly. She was always calm, just as she was always graceful. "If you do not want to wait, then go." Unconsciously, Messana raised herself a little on her toes, but she still had to look up. Semirag stood taller than most men, though so perfectly proportioned that you did not realize it until she stood over you, looking down. "Go? I will go. And he can—" There was no warning, of course. There never was when a man channeled. A bright vertical line appeared in the air, then widened as the gateway turned sideways to open long enough for Demondred to step through, giving them each a small bow. He was all in dark gray today, with a little pale lace at his neck. He adapted easily to the fashions and fabrics of this age. His hawk-nosed profile was handsome enough, though not quite the sort to make every woman's heart beat faster. In a way, almost, and not quite, had been the story of Demondred's life. He had had the misfortune to be born one day after Luz Theron Telamon, who would become the dragon, while Barad Bel Medar, as he was then, spent years almost matching Luz Theron's accomplishments, not quite matching Luz Theron's fame. Without Luz Theron, he would have been the most acclaimed man of the age. Had he been appointed to lead instead of the man he considered his intellectual inferior, an overcautious fool who too often managed to scrape up luck, would he stand here today? Now that was idle speculation, though she had made it before. No, the important point was that Demondred despised the dragon, and now that the dragon had been reborn, he had transferred that contempt whole. "Why?" Demondred raised a hand. "Let us wait until we are all here, Messana, and I will not have to repeat myself." She felt the first spinning of Saidar a moment before the glowing line appeared and became a gateway. Grendal stepped out, for once unaccompanied by half-clad servants, and let the opening vanish as quickly as Demondred had. She was a fleshy woman with elaborately curled red-gold hair. Somewhere she had actually managed to find strength for her high-necked gown. High-necked, but mirroring her mood, the fabric was transparent mist. At times Messana wondered whether Grendal really took note of anything beyond her sensual pleasures. "I wondered whether you would be here," the new arrival said lightly. "You three have been so secretive." She gave a gay, slightly foolish laugh. No, it would be a dire mistake to take Grendal at surface value. Most who had taken her for a fool were long since dead, victims of the woman they disregarded. "Is Samael coming?" he asked. Grendal waved a beringed hand dismissively. "Oh, he doesn't trust you. I don't think the man trusts himself anymore." The strife darkened, a concealing fog. "He's marshalling his armies in Ilion, moaning over not having shock lances to arm them. When he isn't doing that, he's searching for a usable Angreal or Sa'angreal, something of decent strength, of course." Their eyes all went to Messana, and she drew a deep breath. Any of them would have given, well, almost anything, for a suitable Angreal or Sa'angreal. Each was stronger than any of these half-trained children who called themselves Aes Sedai today, but enough half-trained children linked together could crush them all. Except, of course, that they no longer knew how, and no longer had the means in any case. Men were needed to take a link beyond 13, more than one to go beyond 27. In truth, those girls, the oldest seemed girls to her, she had lived over 300 years, quite aside from her time sealed in the boar, and had only been considered just into her middle years. Those girls were no real danger, but that did not lessen the desire of anyone here for Angreal, or better yet the more powerful Sa'angreal. With those remnants from their own time, they could channel amounts of the power that would have burned them to ash without. Any of them would risk much for one of those prizes, but not everything. Not with no real need. That lack did not still the desire, though. Automatically, Messana dropped into a lecturing tone. The White Tower now has guards and wards on their strong rooms inside and out, plus they count everything 4 times each day. The great hold in the Stone of Tyr is also warded, with a nasty thing that would have held me fast had I tried to pass through or untie it. I don't think it can be untied except by whoever wove it, and until then it is a trap for any other woman who can channel. A dusty jumble of useless rubbish, so I've heard, Demondred said in dismissal. The Tyrans gathered anything with even a rumored connection to the power. Messana suspected he had more than hearsay to go on. She also suspected there was a trap for men woven around the Great Hold, too, or Demondred